The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants based on their personal and or professional experience with grief and bereavement. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Lighthouse Beacon podcast. My name is Rami Shami, and I'll be your host for these podcasts. A little background about our organization. We are located in Oakville, Ontario, Canada, but we can provide our services to the Greater Toronto Region. We offer facilitated grief peer support groups to help children, youth, and teens, and their families, however a family is defined, through the grieving process following a death in their family. Our groups are ongoing and open-ended, which offers each family member an opportunity to participate in their own unique way. We launched these podcasts quite some time ago. We're well past our 1,000th download, which is pretty exciting, across the world. I mean, it's really, really an exciting adventure. In an effort to create a greater awareness, not only to children's grief support, but the diversity within the experience of children's grief. But before we begin, we really should, at least in my humble opinion, share a land acknowledgement that honors the land that we're meeting on today, that we're living on today, that we're learning on today, especially given the history of Canada with respect to Indigenous peoples. I acknowledge the land that I'm standing on today is a traditional territory of many nations, including the Mississaugas of the Credit, the Anishinaabe, the Chippewa, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat peoples, and is now home to many diverse First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples. I also acknowledge that Toronto is covered by Treaty 13 signed with the Mississaugas of the Credit and the Williams Treaty signed with the multiple Mississaugas and Chippewa bands. Our special guest today, Corey Sirota, holds a master's degree in social work from McGill University in Montreal, Canada, as well as a graduate certificate in loss and bereavement, where she continues to teach. As a licensed psychotherapist, Corey maintains a private practice specializing in loss and bereavement. She is the author of Someone Died, Now What? A Personal Professional Perspective on Coping with Grief and Loss, and Lost and Found, a Grief Activity Journal. Corey is also the clinical director of Myra's Kids Foundation, which offers free support services to bereaved children and their families. She's also a well-known guest speaker, having presented at numerous conferences and workshops, both locally and nationally. She's married to Andy and has two daughters, one in son-in-law, who loves to laugh. She loves to laugh. And I know that from talking to Corey.
We're going to hear it right now.
We're going to hear it right now. There you go. That's the proof. Good day, Corey, and welcome.
Thanks so much, Rami, for having me.
Absolutely, Corey. You know, I just look at the experience and background and perspective you must bring to children's grief. And I'm sure you recognize, especially in such a diverse nation as Canada, we have so much to offer children who are grieving, but also so many gaps in providing the services that provide that grief support. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey of supporting children? What's changed in the past? And, you know, I don't want to date you at all, in the past 5, 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, I've been at it for like 35 years. So I've seen right. So much change in hospice palliative care. What have you seen over the past few decades change in the way children, teens, and youth and their families are being supported in their grief?
So it's a good news, bad news situation, I suppose, that the bad news was that for a very, very long time, children were, I would call them the forgotten grievers. They were not recognized, and it was all, I believe, in an effort to protect our kids from any adversity. And we thought that that was the way you did it. So I would meet people and work with people who would describe the experience of having a death in their family and putting away the pictures, never speaking their name again, virtually erasing the person from their lives, which was believed, and maybe for some, unfortunately, and that's the bad news, is today still believe that was the best way. That's how we were absolutely protecting them from any sadness or any adversity. Of course, fast forward now, years later, when I'm seeing people in my office that are recipients of that strategy, and they are devastated and have grown up with all kinds of, whether it's phobias or risk-taking behaviors that they've engaged in because they were struggling and realized that they would make up stories in their own heads. And that's the problem, is that's what we do, is when we don't fill in the gaps and the blanks for children who are experiencing grief, they make up their own stories. And so they make some really big assumptions that are very often wrong assumptions that don't go unchecked. That said, the good news is we know that now, and I believe that we're doing much more so that children aren't the forgotten grievers, and letting them acknowledge their grief and allowing them that space to process the experience.
So, Corey, you mean at some time in human history, we didn't know that's how, and when you say we, can we characterize who that we is?
I would say it's a very big generality of Western society is we became very death, historically, people died at home. Families were much more exposed to the all genders, all ages, etc., and therefore they would be a normal part of life was to witness death. Death became much more medicalized, and then people were put in hospitals and making more sanitary, so to speak, conditions. And families became much more mobile, and not everybody lived in the same home, let alone the same community. So much more spread out. Death became much more of that thing that happened in a hospital or away, and therefore lack of exposure made it much more mysterious and much more private or left untalked about, or I don't even know how to describe it, but you know what I mean?
Yeah, I've heard it being described as disenfranchised, like it's been
well,
put somewhere
else.
Well,
that would be the good word, disenfranchised. And I learned a new word a couple of days ago about we need to enfranchise grief. And that's what I see us doing now is how do we do that? And we can talk about that as we continue to chat together, is to take back that disenfranchised behavior and enfranchise it by educating and involving children in the grief and funeral processes, etc.
Yeah, you know, Corey, like if you really look at it, death used to happen so much at home, whether it's Western. I mean, mm-hmm. It still happens at home in many parts of the world. You don't have to look too far. Just look at Mexico and their Day of the Dead and how they honor the dead
peoples, yeah.
Right? In my family, in my Middle Eastern family, it's like, don't take your daughter to a funeral. Don't talk about death. You know,
absolutely.
this is for adults, yeah. Right? And what does that really do to children? I heard you talk about it. They start making up their own stories and thoughts and ideas about it.
It's a very strong message, Rami, that death is not to be talked about, and that when you don't describe or help a child understand it, you're leaving them to make up that story. And so when you say, oh, a cemetery is no place for a child, what's the messenger? What happens at a cemetery that I can't see? And that is one mysterious, but also kids have great imaginations, right? So where do they get it from? They watch TV and they see a movie. I mean, we're kidding ourselves if we think we actually are inoculating our kids by not having those discussions. They're watching Disney movies, and I don't know about you, but any Disney movie I've seen has somebody that died in it.
Right.
So they're watching it. They're making up their own stories. They're also realizing they're not necessarily recognizing that it's not reversible, because it seems reversible. I watched this movie, this person like Mufasa in The Lion King. Hope I'm not ruining it for anybody.
Yeah.
in The Lion King, and dies, and then they put back on the movie, and he's alive again. So if there's no explanations, they're filling in their own pieces to it. And I just want to couch all that with recognizing the developmental level of a child or adolescent is crucial in having these discussions. Because I'm not saying that everybody needs to know every piece of everywhere, but under age 5, they don't necessarily understand the permanency. But over age 5, they start to recognize and understand that death is permanent. It isn't reversible. It's the physical cessation of life. It's universal. All of those concepts start to get more and more understood and embedded. And so we can use that as tremendous life lessons for them about how to process their experience. And learning about death, as far as I'm concerned, it teaches us about life.
I couldn't agree more. Well said. So what have you seen in terms of those life lessons that can be bestowed or learned by children if we present grief in a person-centered way, in a humane way, in a sense of normalcy?
Well, I think it's about helping them understand that death is a normal part of life, and every living thing will at some point die. Some things and people have longer lives, some have shorter lives. But when you don't give them that experience and then they're living it, because nobody is immune, the death rate is 100%. We just don't know when and sometimes don't know how. And I don't mean to sound callous or frivolous about it. That is the reality of making it and helping kids understand that. Then they're not left, like I keep saying, about making up their own stories, but they can appreciate what they have. They can, I'm hugely, we're not even there with interventions and about supporting children, but I believe very much in continuing bonds and how to honor the person who died. They're able to do those kinds of things when they're given the space to do them, which is why I would say I've dedicated my life's work to whichever way I'm doing it, whether it's the camp, the private work, the book, the handbook that I wrote. Everything is about helping kids process this experience, which is a normal life cycle experience, because when they don't, we know from the research, a lot of bereavement studies have told us that kids that don't get that space to do it, they tend to fail grades, they tend to be bullied, they tend to be higher at risk for engaging in risk-taking types of behavior, substance use. Like the numbers don't lie. And when you know, you mentioned this, who are we talking about? Something like 1 in 14 children will have or experience the death of somebody close to them by the age they're 18. Those are Canadian statistics. So it's not like it just, it doesn't happen. It happens, and it happens quite often. It just isn't acknowledged.
Absolutely, Corey. And that brings something to mind. If it's 1 in, how many did you say, 18?
1 in 14, I believe.
1 in 14.
The Canadian statistic, yeah.
So if 1 in 14 have experienced a death of someone close to them, what's the ratio of those children that actually get appropriate children's grief support?
I would say that's part of that goes in the good news column is probably more than used to, but I couldn't quote exactly what that statistic is. I just know that the programs that are out there, like the camps and the support groups and the materials that are more available, the fact that the Canadian Alliance for Children's Grief and Youth is working very hard at getting information out there, that there's a Children's Grief Awareness Day that is recognized all across North America. I know that in Montreal, where I'm from, we got places lit up, we gave out pins, we did education in schools. All of that is all towards working towards awareness of how important it is for children to be involved in understanding and giving them that place and that space to talk about grief.
Yeah, so important. You know, going to the private practice a little bit, do you see children, teens, and youth that come to you that come from situations where their grief is not permission to be expressed?
I would say it's a good question, but it's a tough question, because I would say that the people that are calling and coming to get support recognize that their family member, or in this case, the child or the teen, needs support. Although, having said that, sometimes it's kind of like, here, fix them. A little bit challenging. So I'm grateful that they do call, but they do it because they need the support. And how do I talk to that child about that? Particularly when it's a disenfranchised grief like homicide or suicide. I literally had the conversation this morning with someone who was not comfortable. And it's always after the fact, right? They're not comfortable. They don't want their child to know. And that's really difficult for me to hear, because I will never tell someone what to do. I'll just make suggestions, and I'll say that although I understand that the default reaction is let's tell them it was a heart attack, let's not tell them because, again, we want to protect them, and because it's so taboo to talk about things like that, and I'll, my concern is that they're going to hear it from somebody. So I'll try and coach that caregiver to say, okay, who would you rather them hear it from? Because they will hear about it. It will come out. And I have been there when the, when that happens and had to sort of help that family, or in this, in the case of the child, pick up the pieces of not only now am I dealing with, I'm re-grieving, and I'm also dealing with the fact that you lied to me. And now you're my remaining caregiver and I can't trust you. So to your point, they're coming because they want to help, or they would like to get help for their child or children, and the children would like to get support, but they're not always aware of all the circumstances, and that can make it much more complicated.
No doubt. So what I'm hearing, correct me if I'm wrong, Corey, oftentimes how the person has died will determine how it's presented or not, shared or not, with the children?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I talk about how do you know how someone's going to process grief? And I will talk about, I did a TED talk and I talk about the scars, and scars, as I say, it depends on how many scars you have. And scars stands for, S is how society has processed that death. How, was it an accident? Was it illness? If it was what one might consider normal life cycle process, an elderly person that had an illness, they're going to get, a family's going to get much more support. And whereas when it's something like a homicide or a suicide, people are very, very uncomfortable. So society may not, I don't want to say that that's always the case, may not surround themselves. There may be a lot of judgment and shame. So that's the S. The C is for circumstances. Long-term illness or sudden death. Some people ask me what's better, or which is worse. And I'm like, really? You're asking me that? I'm like, neither. It's not a competition, you know, but how someone dies will have an effect. This A is for ancestry. And this is a big, important piece. How was death talked about in your family? Was it a sweep it under the rug and suck it up, don't talk about it? Or did you have the space to talk about it? Because how a family has generationally spoken about it makes a difference on how someone is going to do their, is going to be grieving, and the messages that that child or anyone in the family will get. The R is for the relationship. And this is another big piece when it comes to children and who died. Sometimes they didn't have a great relationship with the person. Sometimes someone in their immediate family is, it's difficult, but I've even compared it to a pet. They may have a pet that died, maybe a more significant loss to them. And this isn't about judgment. It's just about reality. It's not about who died. It's about the relationship that you had with that person and the meaning of that relationship. But we compare griefs. And I said, not a competition. Nobody has it worse. It's your pain is your pain and my pain is my pain. And then the last S is for support. What kind of support does that child or family member have? Because I did make a big mistake. I used to say, oh, who's in your family? And if they told me they had other family members, I thought they were good. Okay, cool. That's great. And I realized that it's not necessarily family members. It could be a therapist, a group, a family friend. It could be family members, of course, but it's not always. So support can come in many shapes and sizes. So add in all those factors, and all of that has an impact on how someone's going to grieve.
And two things I wanted to actually zone in on is one, the ancestry part,
yeah,
and the other is defining family. How often do we see, especially in today's kind of dynamics of societies and communities and how we define mm-hmm. family, how right. often is, and I see that unfortunately a lot in social services, especially in hospice and grief and bereavement support,
right.
is this idea of this nuclear family or even a slightly extended family. When you spoke to aspects of a family that are just being addressed and acknowledged, pets, friends, therapist, strangers, and if you're experiencing some measure of homelessness, it could be your street family.
Right.
So can we talk a little bit about that in terms of what you experience in children's grief? Is this definition, ever expanding and oscillating definition of family?
I think that if we would not be doing our due diligence in terms of practitioners, if we didn't do, I think I learned it as an ecomap, where you put the person in the middle and then you look at all their existing support systems and what those can look like. And it could be activities that they do, for that matter. It's people, it's places, it's things, what works for them, and not getting caught up in what we think is the best route or the most supportive piece. And that's a whole other part of the discussion we're having, is for anybody who is helping somebody who's grieving, self-awareness is the most important piece that you can. I teach in the School of Social Work, and I say to all the students, if you learn anything from my class, please learn how you show up, who you are, and how that impacts the helping process. Because, again, going back to your point, I was coming back there, Rami, to your point, is that if we decide what their support is or what support should look like, we are not doing our work. We are being biased. We are being judgmental. And that is not what somebody who's grieving, it's not anybody who needs, but certainly somebody who's grieving needs. For we need to acknowledge what's their reality, what's their lived experience, what do they need to help support them, not what do we think they need.
That is the first time I've heard somebody within education on grief and bereavement support, within podcasts, what have you, that somebody mentioned the importance of self-awareness and the self in who is providing the support. And when we talk about diversity, so often it's focused on the generalized common domains of diversity, color of your skin, ethnicity, food, religion, all that, which are important. But diversity, when it speaks to especially grieving, is how somebody grieves, who's around them, and who is providing the support. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an imperative, you know, in that regard. Can you expand on a little bit more? Why is that so important for us to be self-aware in the support we provide?
So you know, I just gave this lovely little acronym about SCARS, but before I ever do that, when I'm ever doing any training with professionals, that's the first thing I talk about is self-awareness. To thy own self be true, know who you are, know how you show up, because we have a lot of power. When we're in a position of support, and someone is vulnerable, we got to know what that power can look like to the person, and for us to even unconsciously show up, make a comment. It could be a comment, it could be in what we're wearing, it could be in the way we stand, look, all our body language, all of that sends a message to that person. Am I safe? Do you get me? Or is this a place that I can truly be myself? Well, I'm not helping anybody if they are not comfortable in acknowledging, in letting down their guard. I have to create that safe space, or some people call it a safe space, some people call it a brave space. You use the language that works for you. I'm going to go with the language that they go with, but what do they need for me to be able to support them? And that includes using the right pronouns, asking them what their pronouns are, and respecting those pronouns, and understanding that not only do people grieve differently based on their ancestry and their backgrounds, but we also bring our own stuff in, but also what their lived experience has been thus far, what they believe they should be doing, what we think how they should be managing their grief. If I send that message that something they're doing is wrong by saying, oh, what do you mean you go to the cemetery, or you don't need to go to the cemetery, or why haven't you gone to the cemetery? Well, some people need to go to the cemetery every day. Some people do not need to go to the cemetery. If there's no magical thing about going or not going, I want to know what that person needs. And the big statement I'll say is, to every client I see or service user, stop being should on. I'm going to say, everybody's going to tell you what you should do. I'm going to be the first person not to tell you what you should do, because I don't know what you should do. Tell me what you need to do, because according to somebody, you're doing it wrong.
You know, no doubt, Corey, it's to somebody, there's always somebody that have a should and a direction. But you mentioned something, you know, even the way you seem to engage somebody who's grieving, it's almost as if you're learning about not just about how they're grieving, but about who and how they are.
isn't that the best way to start off any therapeutic alliance?
I couldn't agree more.
not, and just, I mean, I will, again, say it to students, say it to anybody, we're human. We're bringing in us with all of our baggage. As long as we know that and we're aware of that, that's half of it.
And you know, Corey, I appreciate a word you just used that I often don't hear in grief support, and that is alliance. Can you expand on that?
How do you create a therapeutic alliance is by showing up and asking questions and letting them know that they are essentially in the driver's seat. It's their story, their lived experience, and then allowing them the space to say what they need to say without listen, without judgment, and not just listen to respond, but listen to hear.
So, you know, so much of this resonates with me, Corey, especially how you're talking about autonomy and self-direction and safety. Yeah. You know, I mean, to me, those are also culturally humble, trauma-informed principles. And when applied to grieving, and especially children's grieving, I think it really can change how that therapeutic alliance unfolds.
I agree. I mean, this is, I guess, how I have always practiced. So when the new terminologies come up and I'm like, okay, good. Because I love to learn, but it's very validating to hear that what I believe I've been doing, although I'm always open for interpretation and to learn, is really in line with trauma-informed care. One quote that I had heard that I really love, so I hope we'll be able to be integrated into this discussion, is instead of focusing on making children feel better, we need to focus on holding their pain.
So Corey, I love that quote. And, you know, a lot of the work that I do in hospice palliative care, it's called sitting with the pain. So can you expand on that quote a little bit more and tell us how it applies to the work you do?
The concept is grief cannot be fixed. It's not something that needs to be fixed. It needs to be witnessed. And so when we are there in the moment with the bereaved, whether it's a child, family member, or all the children, a group, it's being there and not imposing anything and just giving them that space to express anything they want to. And sometimes we have to give them permission. I wish we didn't, but we need to model, because of background, history, ancestry, about that it is okay to talk about. It's okay to say that things you love, that it's okay to say things that maybe you didn't love. So giving them that space and not feeling like everything we say has to be perfect, and it, because we just that concept of kids have to be happy. We have to be, I mean, of course we want people to be happy, but you know what? We wouldn't know happiness if we didn't experience sadness. So it's about balance, I guess. And focusing on holding their pain is being able to bear witness to whatever experience they have.
Mm-hmm. And you you incorporate quite insightful acronyms, and you had one that you mentioned, you've mentioned in conversation with me. Can you expand on that one and tell us what it is?
Sure. So recently I had followed the work of Tachelle Bordier, and she spoke about these five A's of culturally conscientious practice. And I thought that they would be very appropriate for our discussion. So I'm just going to go over them as she has explained them. So the first A is acknowledge. We need to acknowledge what the experience has been, what the lived experience has been for the child or adolescent. So good, bad, or ugly, accident, illness, homicide, suicide, let's talk about it. And then when we have talked about it and helped them acknowledge it, we ask them a question. We clarify it to know, and I love this concept of being curious, right? We need to be curious. So we ask them, is that correct? Do I understand that correctly? And then we help the child accept that the grief might not be recognized, that maybe they're angry about something, maybe there's leftover unfinished business. So that's okay, that not everything is tied up in a nice, neat little box. That's what grief is. It's messy. It's not linear. It doesn't follow a nice, neat little path. So that would be the accept. The fourth A is align, and that's a line where for them, where privilege is perhaps in their life, where they are in their life, that what is needed for them to feel like they are in sync with what is going on, and that it's okay not to always be in sync with everyone else. I'd say everyone in your family grieves differently, or grief, no two people grieve the same way. Even within the same family and the same loss, are there going to be different reactions? And that's okay. And then as a practitioner, the last A, which is so simple, is apologize. Sometimes we might not get this right. And it's okay to say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry if I said something that inadvertently seemed judgmental or pretentious. We can all make errors, right? To err is human. And so it is very humane to apologize. So those were the five A's of culturally conscientious practice. And that comes out of Tachelle Bordere's work.
Thank you for sharing that with us, Corey. But you mentioned something, you mentioned the word privilege. Can you expand on what that means?
I think that it means different things to different people. And because Tachelle Bordere was working in terms of Black youth, so where sometimes we can, as a society, put people in boxes, they themselves, as people from different races, can put themselves in boxes. And so I wouldn't pretend to give an ideal definition of it, but I think that privilege is something that is not necessarily tangible that you can hold on to, but it's something that is felt or believed or perceived from different races and cultures.
Thank you. The term privilege has a lot of interest in that and what it means today, and how it creates different hierarchies of, especially within social services, of who receives care and who doesn't. Yeah. There's been a lot of privilege in even who receives grief support, or especially when it applies to children. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say that a certain demographic who maybe is financially more comfortable has the means to seek out support, and that is a problem. That's a systemic problem, because everybody, like I said, death rate is 100%. Everybody has the right, or should have the right, to receive support and services, but not necessarily does everybody get it. That's why I'm grateful for programs like Myra's Kids Foundation, where we recognize that everybody grieves and everyone needs a place and a space to do so. And so we work very hard at ensuring that the program is free, and there's a lot of programs across North America that are free if you look for them, and so that everyone who wants to get support has the right to get it, but is able to get it.
Yes, that ableness, right? However, that is facilitated. Now, you're the clinical director at MyRisk. Can we dive into that a little bit and talk a little bit more about MyRisk Kids Foundation, how you provide the free support, how support was facilitated, and of course, expand a little bit more on your role at MyRisk?
With pleasure. So I was very fortunate to be asked and invited to work with John Ryder, the CEO of Myra's Kids Foundation. It's a free nonprofit program for children who are bereaved. And the signature program is a weekend long free camp that we bring up children who are ages 6 to 17 who have experienced any loss of anyone, any way, any how. So we have children that have experience loss by homicide, suicide, accident, and illness. And we bring them up to camp, and it's not about how the person died, but it's a place and a space separate from their caregivers to do activities that honor the memory of the person who died, and as well as have fun, just be kids, because very rarely are they in an environment where everybody is somewhat like them in terms of the fact that somebody in their lives, and I won't even say a loved one. I think language is really important. It's not always a loved one, but everyone there has had a person in their life that has died. And so they come up, and we do this together. It's run by volunteers and trained volunteers and grief counselors. We bring up doctors, nurses, funeral directors to do all kinds of activities and programs. Aside from that, because I know that grief just taking kids up for one weekend is very nice, but it's not enough that we grieve all year round. And so we created a family-like environment, and the program is non-denominational. So, and I try and really do my best to have volunteers that reflect the multicultural community that we have coming up to camp. And nothing is religious about what is at camp. It's non-denominational and welcome to everybody who would like to be part of the program. So during the year, we do holiday parties and events like Halloween, Valentine's Day, Mother's Day, Father's Day, Children's Grief Awareness Day. We do another program so that kids can always feel like they have a place and a space to continue to connect with others. So because we know holidays can be particularly difficult for family members, we also offer some support groups for the caregivers and guardians and some other different kinds of activities and initiatives that are available to them. We created a lost and found children's grief activity book that again works both for children and for adolescents. That is, we have a French version and an English version to give them activities that they can do, both written activities or discussion activities that they can do, all in the goal of helping them honor the memory of the person who died, remind them that we see them, we hear them, we know they're hurting, and that it's okay to talk about grief and loss. Sometimes I think I heard it a long time ago, and I love talking about death won't kill you.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. You know, and Catherine Hepburn had some great quotes about death and dying and grief and loss. Yeah. But you know, something you mentioned, Corey, that that I find is really interesting, important, and a controversial topic right now, especially within social sector and children's grief, is definitions and language. And you spoke to how powerful language is.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the term loved one and sorry for your loss?
Let me do the loved one's easier one. Loved one is just recognizing, again, this is all about, regardless of gender, regardless of race, cultural background, to say loved one implies something that is not necessarily true. And if we're going to be culturally sensitive and sensitive in general to the clientele we're supporting, we have to remember that every relationship is different and won't necessarily always be, loved one won't be the best definition and descriptions. I think we're like leaving out a whole group of people when we, I'm going to say pigeonhole, I guess, and get stuck on language. I think you've taught me a lot about language, even in the little bit of time we've known each other. I always think about certain things now, and I appreciate that because we're always learning. So to remove what we didn't realize was potentially judgments, because how is that person going to hear that? And if I say loved one, then maybe they don't think they're fitting in my camp because it wasn't a loved one.
You know, I look at the term loved one. We still use it a lot in healthcare, especially in grief and bereavement and hospice and what have you. I've challenged, you know, the whole feel of it, because I'll tell you, for example, my father would be considered a loved one, but my childhood developmental trauma at his hand in his life and the abuse I experienced, I do not consider him a loved one. But, you know, my friends, some pets, you know, including my partner's a pet, which is a starling, you know, named Neva, that would be more considered a loved one. But you know, when my father dies, he's not a loved one in my mind, but I'm going to grieve. I'm going to grieve the loss I had of a childhood. I'm going to grieve him for not being the father that I wanted, even though he's not considered a loved one. So I think that terminology, as you're speaking to, that language really excludes many people when it comes to grieving. Then they feel like their grief isn't permission to be experienced. And I think that's where the disenfranchisement can set in.
Right. Yeah, very much so. And I really thank you for being so open and candid and honest, because this teaches and you're a role model for it's okay to talk about it. And let's bring it into the desire or the automatic response is, I'm sorry that you had that experience. And you know, I struggle with that all the time, this concept of saying, I'm sorry. I mean, so I think about it and I say it to a kid and I say, why are you apologizing? You didn't kill him. Like, it's our go-to. And I have yet to really come up with something else, but I try and stay away from I'm sorry. Instead, I just want to say I'm really sad that that happened to you.
Yeah, thank you, Corey, because I appreciate and respect your professional and personal experience. I've struggled with that term. I remember saying it just once to a child that wasn't even within my work. And the look they gave me, and they said, huh, what, you're sorry? And yeah. They didn't say anything more than that. And I'm like, you know what? That child has just taught me something. And I too have stayed away from, as much as possible, this whole, I'm sorry for your loss, which almost depersonalizes the person because we don't use their name. We don't even use their role or designation or pronoun or anything like that. We just say your loss. And you know, loss is so expansive that we generalize it like that and keep it at arm's length. And when children hear that, I wonder if they feel that we are keeping their experience of the death of the person that's important to them at arm's length.
Well, also, I think you're right. I think that the kids are very literal. So the same way I have for years said, you can't say, please use the words death and dying, although people are very uncomfortable with it, but that's because we live in a grief illiterate society and we need to do more education to make it normative to say the words. Well, that's what happened. And that's why, and then I'll challenge someone, why are you uncomfortable with saying it? Because we live in a society that doesn't use the words and has hundreds of euphemisms. And I do mean literally hundreds of euphemisms instead of saying died. So similarly, you know, saying that they died from an accident. Well, what's an accident to a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old? Someone peed in their pants and they died, or they went to sleep, or, you know, as you might have heard a little bit through this interview, and you and I have had other discussions, humor is a really important piece of the work I do, not ever to make fun of or instead of, but as a way to relieve some stress. But I will always say that, you know, the child that you say, you know, honey, your cat died and you know, because God needed your cat. And the kid looks at you and says, what did God need a dead cat for?
You're true to your bio, you know, about the loves to laugh. Yeah. And I love the fact that you use it naturally in your work. Yeah, amazing. Amazing, Corey. So you're a clinical director at Myra's. You have a professional practice and you're a published author, which I believe your book is on Amazon. Is that correct? Can you tell us a little bit more about your book, Someone Died, Now What?
Yeah, so Someone Died, Now What is, and there's a reason. It's called A Personal and Professional Perspective on Coping with Grief and Loss. And I wrote it, probably I published it about 5 years ago. And what you didn't ask, which is probably the first question most people ask, is why do you do this? Right? How do you do this? Why do you do this? And everyone has a story. And mine is no different. I had a brother that died many years ago, at this point, 35 years ago. And I learned very quickly that nobody really wants to talk about it. And no, even though I was already a social worker, so I had some skills, but I didn't. I was in community, and I said, no, this is something we really need more work on. And so I set out, not immediately, because all of us do need to do our grief work. I set out a few years later to start to really focus on this area. And I'm very proud to say that so many years later, I wrote the book in his memory. I do the work that I do, and everything that I do, I believe I honor him every day with the work that I do. And that's why I don't just come at this from an academic perspective, but also from the personal perspective. And I will never say to someone, my experience is mine, theirs is theirs. But I think I understand sometimes maybe a bit more than others might what it sounds like when somebody dismisses your grief.
And you know, Corey, you just taught me something there, because I took it for granted that you probably had a significant loss of someone close to you somewhere in your life for you to be drawn in this work, but you never really know who's grieving when and where, right? I know I was just on my street like last spring, and I tell the story because it's so impactful. And 3 doors down from where I live, this man was standing outside with a bunch of golf clubs, and they caught my eye because unfortunately I'm addicted to golf. And I said to him, hey, those are really cool. Like, you know, and I started talking to him about the shape and size. And right away, I don't know what he sensed or what, maybe the way I was asking, what have you. He says, yeah, they were my brothers. And I picked up the word were. And I said, were your brothers? And he says, yeah, he died about a couple of months ago. And we got into a half an hour discussion on that, but you never really know. And you talk about legacy and honoring, when you know, you honor your brother, may I ask what his name is?
Andy.
Andy, when you talk about honoring Andy, he was bringing out those golf clubs and he said to me, you know, he didn't use the term honoring. He just said, you know, yeah. I'm bringing them out. I'm going to go play around because it reminds me of my brother. And he's honoring, you know, his brother through this activity. And, you know, I think a lot of, and correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of children's grief support is in honoring, especially through their name and who and what they are, the person who had died in that child's life.
Well, the continuing bonds are, to me, where I think we all have a tremendous ability to make an impact. And I love that you had the conversation. I threw out the term grief literacy. Grief literate means that somebody says that and you don't, as many people might have, just skip by it. I don't want to get into that conversation, but because you just simply said, were, that's all he needed, you know, that's all he needed. Because most people, the big joke is, I mean, my husband makes fun of me all the time. He says, how do you get everybody's life story? Because I listen and I show that I really am interested. Because as much as we don't want to talk about it, when somebody comes across somebody where they see that you can, of course they want to talk about it. But they have to feel safe enough to do so. And you made that space for that person. And God bless you for doing that.
Thank you, Corey. I can't help it. My ears perk up and I'm like, were? What do you mean were?
And all
of a sudden, but you're right. It's about holding that, however you call sacred space or brave space, however that's termed nowadays. But it's the attentiveness. No, it's the, sometimes it's the gentle curiosity. It's actually a lot of times it's the compassion. I felt for him. I mean, we started sharing this connection about, you know, the golf clubs and stuff. But when he said we're his brothers, right away, there's a piece of me that said, oh, what's happened here? Why is he carrying his body like that? Why is he really touching those clubs with such, you know, such gentleness and care? And I see that a lot with children. And again, share your insights on this if I'm off base, is that they express grief in very unique ways, especially tactile. It's not always what is said, but how they hold the urn or the special item that reminds them of that person, correct?
Yeah, well, a great story for you. At our camp, we do these wonderful activities that help honor the memory, and one of them is a memory board. So everyone has to bring a picture of the. They're invited to put it up. They can say it. They can have somebody else say it. One at a time, they go up and they introduce us. They don't have to say how, but they introduce us to their person. And I've been doing it for years. Lovely, very heartfelt activity. And one summer, a couple of summers ago, there was a big issue because Scotch tape doesn't work so well and it's messy and it takes a long time and there's a lot of kids. So we were using pins, little thumbtacks or whatever they're called, for we had a board that we put them on. And there was a child that took tremendous offense to tacking a photo of their person, which... Wow. You can't always anticipate, but thankfully this child was forthcoming enough, and we had to think about, okay, how are we going to do this? Even if it was a photocopy of a picture, you know, we had to respect that for them, they just couldn't. Or another child, now that I'm thinking about it, that didn't want to, once we put up the board, then we go do another activity, and one child could not leave the room. He did not want to walk and turn their back against the picture.
And that's the nimbleness I find that is necessary in children's grief, to be able to almost proverbially dance with what is presented to us. You know,
beautifully said.
You know, Corey, I don't want to date ourselves, but I think in our school days, it used to be called thumbtacks, and now they call them push pins.
Okay. There you go. Okay, now everybody knows how old I am. Okay, thanks.
And myself, right?
Yeah.
Circling back to something, some words of wisdom that you mentioned, and you talked about continuing bonds, Corey.
Yeah.
And when you talk about those continuing bonds, it makes me think of not just the lack of continuity, but even if not the alienation of the bonds that are experienced with disenfranchised grief. Can you expand on what is disenfranchised grief and what is this re-enfranchisement of grief?
So disenfranchised grief is any grief, any loss, any death, where it's not recognized, where it makes other people essentially uncomfortable. So it was a term coined by Kenneth Doka. And what I will typically see in my office is people with disenfranchised grief because they've had nowhere else to express it. So something, it could be homicide, suicide, miscarriage, huge disenfranchised grief, because it's uncomfortable to talk about, I'm sorry to sound so crude, but dead babies. Nobody wants to talk about that. Or, well, you didn't really get to know the baby. Like, it's completely dismissed. So that's what disenfranchised grief is, when you don't have a space or a place to express what you're experiencing. And kids, if we think, in an effort to protect them, as I started at the beginning of our conversation, if we think this is how we're doing, we're basically disenfranchising the grief. But I want to add in another term that is very important to know, which is suffocated grief. And that was also coined by Tachel Bordere, because that's taking disenfranchised grief and it's almost like punishing the experience. So think about a child who goes to school after there's been a death of a family member or someone in their lives, and they might be acting out because they don't know how to express themselves. So now they're getting punished, detention, yelled at, ostracized for their behavior, but no one stopped to say, wait a sec, what? Maybe there's a reason that this child is behaving like that. So they're being, not only is it being disenfranchised and not recognized, it's also being punished, and that's suffocated grief. So those two terms together, now flip it and say that enfranchised grief is saying, I see you, I hear you, talk to me about it, tell me about it. And it, for me, you know, I talked earlier about should, as long as the behavior is not illegal, immoral, or dangerous, and sometimes I joke, or it'll grow and it'll grow back, it's fine. It's fine, because everyone's going to do something different. So what is it that child, one needs to talk about it. One might need to have a separate space. One needs to be in a group. One needs to get an extension on a paper or on the assignment that has to happen. I tell teachers all the time, I just did crisis intervention in school. You know the child. I'll always start with, you know the child best. If it's a child that was always academically up to date, and now they need it, that makes sense. But a child perhaps that you know when sometimes we don't get it exactly right, but within reason, to understand that, to make, look at who that child is, look at what's happened, and make space for everything that they might need to do in helping them process this. That's enfranchising them, is bringing it back and respecting who they are, what their lived experience is. If they've had to move, if somebody now has to go to work, like, what has changed? Because there's the loss, the death of someone is the primary death and loss, but there's secondary losses that go along in that family. So enfranchising is recognizing what else in their family has changed. And how can I help them with that?
Oh, I love that term, Corey. And you know, that's why I love doing these podcasts. I get to talk to brilliant minds like yourself who are out there in the communities and in organizations that bring this, you know, progressive knowledge and language so that we could share it with our listeners across this wonderful world. So thank you for that. That's brilliant. And if I can shift gears, I know something we missed in your bio was, and you mentioned it, I'm glad you did, was your TED Talks. And yeah, your TED Talk, Lost and Found, Creating New Normals After Someone You Love Dies. Can we talk about those new normals, especially as it relates to children, right, teens, and youth?
Yes, absolutely. The most often uttered question I get from people is, when am I going to feel normal again? And the most difficult thing I ever tell anyone, or not that I tell, or I share, is that the person that you were is not the person that you are now. And that's hard to say, but I don't think anyone, regardless of age, doesn't know that that's true. And that they, so to help normalize the fact that there, it will be a, some people don't love this term, I do, a new normal. It's going to be, it doesn't mean that they're completely different. And I'll explain this to every child, adolescent and adult, young adult and adult that I work with, is finding ways to move forward, not move on, but move forward without that person in your life, but finding ways to create the bonds, as we talked about, bring them with you, but in a different way. It's not going to be the same relationship that it was supposed to be or that you imagined, but it still can be a relationship. I love the fact that I will reiterate over and over again that death ends a life, not a relationship, and that the person is still in you. And so what are the things that you can do? So part of my TED Talk was about how do you create new normals after someone you love dies? And one of the things is recognizing, and all the psychoeducation that I do and I think we is incumbent upon us to do, is to help kids and adults understand that grief is a process, not an event, that it looks like a roller coaster, peaks and valleys, times that are more difficult and times that are less painful. I won't say not painful, just more manageable. Recognizing and helping them understand everybody grieves differently, even within the same family. Realizing that spiritually, that we all will experience our own definitions of how whatever spirituality means for that person, and not to impose for others to impose their own spiritual beliefs on that person. You choose what makes sense for you and your family. That it's okay to talk about the person who died. And if you are having trouble with that, find people. And some of my clients will say, I call them feel good people, that you can surround yourself with where you can speak about the person, that it's okay to laugh, and that every feeling is okay and normal, and you're not going crazy. I'll talk about triggers with them. What's normal is that there'll be moments where you get triggered, and whether it's a song, a can of soup at the grocery store, a smell, something someone says. But I'll also love to talk about glimmers, those moments that you make you smile as you remember the person who died. And I hope that many people have those glimmers. And then we'll also talk about things like how you honor the memory of the person. And that is everything from creating a foundation to making their favorite soup, lighting a candle, saying stories around a table around the holiday, or just in general, not being afraid to say their name, and just anything that they can do that will help them feel connected. Because I certainly don't want to tie that to financially honoring them. There's so many ways and creative ways, and it has to be meaningful to that person or that family. So that's what I mean by creating new normals.
Oh, I love it. Thank you, Corey. And I love that word. What a beautiful word, glimmers. I'm going to borrow it, okay, in the grief support that
Absolutely.
I provide. I'm going to start talking about glimmers. And the people I support, the clients, are like, where'd you get that word from? I'm like, I'll tell you where I got it from. You know?
In true disclosure, I don't remember where I heard it, but I heard it. And I said, that one's a great one. And that's what we all have to show, because it's such a nice piece. We forget, you know, it's sad. Yes, it's sad for people to experience the death of someone in their lives, but it doesn't have to only be sad. And let's remember that there can be. And I pray that for many people they find many glimmers.
And you know, Corey, we talked just before we came on air about the purpose of this particular podcast, and that's it right there. You know, it's sharing language as such, interventions, processes, dispelling myths and phobias, explaining terminology and engagements, and really highlighting how incredibly diverse and unique the experience and processing of grief truly is. I mean, uh-huh. I look at, when I talk to my dad way back in the day, I'm like, Dad, how did you folks do death in the homeland, uh-huh. as he called it, you know, back home, Rami, you know, he talks in his, anyways. And he says his father was like this, his grandfather was like that, his grandmother was like this, his mother was like this, and they were all very similar in how they processed, maybe not processed, but how he described they processed, or at least engaged and mm-hmm. navigated grief.
Right.
But I look at my quote unquote family between my parents, myself, and my daughter. My daughter's exposed to death and dying in hospice all the time because I teach her that. I take her
right.
to Emily's
right.
house and Palcare and Margaret Bain, and she has a language to it. And then I have it because I'm working in the field. And then my parents are still, don't take your daughter
right.
to a funeral, right? And you yeah. look at that intergenerational piece. When you talked about families and living in the same home and all these diversities of uh-huh. how we are influenced in the way we express and share grief, it's so incredibly unique. And especially, I think at no other time in human history is it as unique and diverse as it is today, how we engage grief. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I'm happy for it. I will tell you, I'm not happy for COVID, but I will say that COVID was a big factor because it was so in your face and so pervasive, so much death, dying, changes, uncertainty, that it was a big push, I found anyway, to have more conversations about death and dying.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more because, I was very fortunate and maybe not so fortunate to be on the front line of it all. You know, Corey, you also talked about this piece of normalizing a new normal. You talked about it, my apologies, yeah. A new normal. Is that part of what the intentionality of your other book, your grief journal called Lost and Found?
The work I do is all part of that. It's the work, it's actually the camp and any groups or any lectures or workshops I do are about helping people normalize the experience and understand that this is a normal grief and the reaction to death is a normal life cycle experience, and it's not unusual. It's there's nothing wrong with you. You're grieving. People often get confused about depression and grief, and my humble explanation is that with grief, they look a lot alike, but with grief, grief, there's a reason to be sad and many other feelings that you have, whereas depression, you don't need a reason.
Yeah. What else can I say, Corey? I mean, I could talk to you for quite some time, I got to tell you, but...
Let me tell you a story which may make the podcast, but to your point about how generationally we've changed. So similar, I was going to ask you, well, how come where did the cycle of the way in which you handle grief change? And you explained that working in palliative care and hospice, so your child was more exposed. Similarly, working in a funeral home for 5 years and having had the experience, but just making sure that it wasn't going to be a taboo topic in my house. So I was very much pro involving and talking to children about death and dying. So when an uncle of ours died and my kids were about 7 and 9 at the time, I said, oh, they're coming to the funeral. And everyone was fine with that. And then I said, and they're also coming to the cemetery. And I started to get pushback, to the point that I thought, am I doing something wrong? But I was like, I knew that this is what I need to be doing. And so I explained to them, it was going to be their first funeral, but they knew their uncle. And I explained what was going to happen at the funeral parlor and then at the cemetery. And so we spoke about it, and I made sure that there was somebody that could be with them because they needed accompaniment. And so we went, and so they sat through the service, and then we went to the cemetery, and one of my kids at the time had to be involved and did know and see everything, so she made a complete beeline for the front of where the burial was taking place, and she was standing next to me, and maybe I was holding her hand, and my father-in-law, whose brother had died, very close to each other. He was, it was devastating for him, was standing there in the tradition that we belong to. You put earth on the casket. Everyone's invited to put some earth on the casket as part of assisting in the burial. So he took his turn to put earth on the casket, and he was standing, like we were standing behind him. And as he did that, he stood away, and my daughter left me and went over to him, totally unprompted, went over to him and grabbed his hand. And I'm watching this because I'm behind them. And you see him he didn't know what was going on. And you see him look down and grab her hand and kiss her on the forehead. And I was so touched by it. It's probably one of the first times I'm telling the story without crying. And I was so touched by it. And I was just like, I knew I did the right thing. I knew that by involving her, at the worst possible time, or one of the worst possible experiences in his life, here he is reminded of the circle of life being supported by his granddaughter, which I just was like, oh, there you see, you have it. And now there's kind of an addendum to this story. So the other part of it was that we went to another funeral, and now my daughter had been to funerals, so she knew what was happening. And we weren't going to the cemetery because we were just going to the service. And at the end of the service, she goes, says to us, totally unprompted, "Hurry, Mom, I don't want to miss the good part."
Wow, Corey.
So, just to say, it really is about what you expose them to in the message.
Absolutely.
You
know, I think we don't. Thank you so much for sharing that beautiful, beautiful personal story. And we don't often give children enough space, credit, acknowledgement for how they can naturally, with guidance and openness, share in grief. That's beautiful. And, that's got to really stick as a parent. That's got to really stick with you.
So thank you for inviting me to share some thoughts and to keep this on the community agenda.
Yeah, thank you, Corey. Well, thank you for spending the time with us. Is there anything else you want to put out there? Any words of wisdom and insights and brilliance they want to share with us?
Oh, gosh. I just always like to tell people the way I sign my book, be the things you loved most about the person who died. And like I said, death ends a life, not a relationship.
And that's the continuing bond, is it not?
Yeah.
Thank you, Corey. I can't thank you so much for your time today.
Appreciate it.
Well, folks, for more information at Myris Foundation, please visit the website at myriskids.ca. For more information on Corey's work, please visit her website at www.coreysirota.com, as well as on her Facebook, Instagram, X, formerly known as Twitter, and LinkedIn pages. For more information about our program at Lighthouse for Grieving Children, visit us at www.lighthousegriefsupport.org. And you can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. My name is Rami Shami. This has been the Lighthouse Beacon Podcast. Take good care of yourselves, folks, and look forward to having you with us again on the podcast.